From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Republican Senate health care bill comes up against a hard reality this week. After weeks of talks behind closed doors, staffers are now supposed to start drafting the actual language of the bill. It'll be a crucial test of whether Republicans in the Senate are able to find a compromise that will be acceptable to both far-right and moderate members. Sarah Cliff joins us now. She's senior policy correspondent at Vox, where she co-hosts The Weeds podcast. Sarah, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And where are we on the Senate bill at this point?
So we're kind of getting to the hard part of legislating. The senators have been meeting and talking and having this working group on health care, but they've gotten to the point where they say they really need to start drafting the bill. So the senators themselves, they are on recess right now. They're out across the country back in their home states, and the staff are back here in Washington, D.C., getting started on actually writing what will be the Senate's version of a bill to repeal and replace Obamacare.
And do we know at this point if it's starting to look like the House bill or if it's going to look very different?
So this is something we don't know a lot about at this point. The Senate has been quite clear that they want to start their own bill. That being said, you are starting to see some rumblings from senators saying, actually, it might be kind of similar to the House bill. Bob Corker, one of the senators from Tennessee, he told some reporters earlier this week that he expects it to be about 70 to 80% the same as the House bill. So that still leaves some space for big differences. But I think one of the things they're seeing is there's kind of, you know, only so many ways to do this. And, you know, when your goal is repealing Obamacare, you're going to have a decent amount of overlap between any sort of legislative effort.
Well, the House was criticized for passing its version of the bill without any public hearings and before the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office had been able to score it. Last week, Senator Corker, who you mentioned, criticized his own party for doing the same in the Senate. He said it's a very awkward process at best. There are no experts. There's no actuarials. Why is the Senate doing it in this way when the House got criticized for the same thing?
A lot of this seems to be driven by Senate leader Mitch McConnell. You know, you are right, Jeremy, that this is a very closed process. Normally in the Senate, you work through committees. In this case, it would be the Senate Finance Committee and the Senate Help Committee, which oversee kind of money and healthcare issues, who would hold hearings, do the drafting. The Senate is not using that normal process. They have convened this 13-member working group, and they are the ones kind of putting this bill together. And I think a lot of it comes down to Senator McConnell's leadership style, where he wants to have a very small group involved. And I think, you know, it does defend them from leaks to the press, but it also leaves them vulnerable to criticisms that they really aren't having a very open process around this.
What about outside groups? The AARP is targeting five senators who have expressed some reservations about the health care bill passed by the House. Here's part of an ad that they're running in those five states.
All right, let's get started. You're both over 50?
Yes.
Okay, that'll cost you.
Why?
The new health care bill in Congress. If you're over 50, insurance companies can charge you five times more. It's an age tax.
An age tax. How much pressure are senators getting from outside groups, powerful ones like the AARP?
I think they're getting a decent amount right now. One of the things we definitely saw with the House bill is that basically every large healthcare lobby opposed the American Health Care Act. This included the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association. You know, that being said, I've kind of seen lobby groups so far holding their fire. You don't see a lot of really aggressive advertising at this point. I think that's a bit strategic. You know, big lobbies, they want to be able to work with the Senate. They want to show up and say, hey, let us have a seat at the table. Let us kind of tell you how this would affect our various constituents. So you don't see a lot of, you know, really aggressive ramped up advertising or messaging at this point. You know, that being said, I think if this moves closer to passage, if we see text of an actual bill and there are things that groups don't like, then you can expect kind of the advertising to really ratchet up as they focus on particular provisions in the eventual bill.
So, Sarah Cliff, how does this play out from here? And is there a chance that at the end of the day, we end up with Obamacare?
There is a chance, I think. It's really unpredictable. You know, when we had the House voting on the American Health Care Act a few weeks ago, it really seemed like they didn't have the votes up until the moment when they finally got over the finish line. And I think that, you know, informs how I watch the Senate, where it is an uphill battle for the Senate. It'll be very hard for them to get 50 senators on board with a bill. But, you know, they were able to do it in the House. And I think there is this very strong drive in the Republican Party to repeal Obamacare after making this campaign promise. We are just watching in D.C. to see if the bill that comes out of the Senate is something that can get enough support to repeal Obamacare.
And meanwhile, we're hearing stories about insurers pulling out of certain markets, which the Republicans say is evidence that Obamacare is collapsing. Democrats are now starting to say, no, they're leaving because you're creating such uncertainty in the healthcare marketplace. What's true?
So I think you can split the blame for that problem really between the two parties. You know, one of the things that is true about Obamacare, even before Trump came into office, is that it struggled to attract health insurance companies. During last summer, when President Obama was still in office, you saw big insurance companies like Aetna and United Health leaving the marketplaces. So you go into the situation where the marketplaces already, you know, have a pretty sparse amount of competition. You know, that being said, President Trump and really a lot of uncertainty and ambiguity around what he wants to do on Obamacare, that's only made the problem worse. You see bigger premium increases. You see some insurance companies flat out leaving the market saying, you know, we are trying to do this, but, you know, given that we have a president who's trying to repeal the law, we just don't feel comfortable being in the marketplace. So, you know, I see that the law itself had its flaws that made it difficult for insurance companies to stay. And the Trump administration has really kind of amped up those flaws and made it even more difficult.
That's Sarah Cliff, senior policy correspondent at Vox, who co-hosts the Weeds podcast. Sarah, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Those are demonstrators in the gallery during the last day of the Texas legislative session yesterday, protesting a new law, SB4, that in effect overrides sanctuary cities. Things got ugly. The protesters were escorted out. Some legislators on the floor got into a shoving match, Democrats and Republicans accusing each other of making death threats. Ben Philpott is senior editor at KUT in Austin. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
Boy, what a scene. We understand the Republican state rep Matt Rinaldi told Democrats that he had called immigration officials to arrest demonstrators who had signs saying they were illegal. That reportedly got some Hispanic legislators furious. F-bombs were dropped. Threats made. Have tempers cooled today?
Well, you know, everybody's happy that the legislative session's over, so I think tempers have cooled in that nobody has to be around each other today. Yeah. They're all headed back to district or, you know, relaxing with a nice brunch in Austin before they head back to district. So I think in that sense, yeah, tempers have cooled a bit.
Well, what does this say about this law, SB4? A lot of tensions behind it. The legislature passed it. It would compel local police to detain people at the request of federal immigration officials, something sanctuary cities don't do, they say, because it erodes trust in their local police. Look, we spoke to the mayor of Austin, and he said Attorney General Jeff Sessions assured him that that kind of detention in the Texas law is not supposed to be mandatory. It's voluntary. So what's going to happen with this law?
Well, and in fact, during the debate in the legislature on this bill, both the bill author and sponsor said that they did not know of sanctuary cities within Texas. So it's going to be interesting to see how this ends up being applied. Obviously, court cases are have already been filed. Court cases are coming soon. And we're going to have to see if maybe the court can come up with a definition of sanctuary cities. What does that actually mean so that you can or cannot levy penalties on the city or the law enforcement officers, you know, with these policies?
We should just explain that even cities like Austin, the mayor would not come out and say we are a sanctuary city. He just said,
right,
we will only do what we voluntarily have to do. So we'll see how that plays out. But meanwhile, the session there in Texas ended without a decision on the so-called bathroom bill, which would require people to use public restrooms according to their sex at birth. Does that mean that bill is dead?
It is definitely dead for this legislative session, as that has ended. The lieutenant governor here, Dan Patrick, has been calling for the last couple of weeks that, knowing it was in trouble during the regular session, that it should be added to a special legislative session. It should be added to the agenda for an extra 30-day session to get something passed. And we certainly could see a 30-day session. There was an issue with a bill not passing that would end up allowing a handful of state agencies, including our medical board, to go away before the next time the lawmakers could come back into Austin. So a special session is likely, but we will have to see whether or not he can get that on the agenda.
Some of the bills there in Texas are tied up in court, one for a new voter ID law, and there are some restrictions on abortion. But the lawmakers did approve a bill that would allow adoption agencies to turn away adoptive parents on religious grounds. Just in the minute we have, what does that mean?
Yeah, it's for adoptions and through the foster care system. The state has been privatizing a little bit more its foster care system, and this is the kind of religious liberty bill or amendment that you have seen, you know, throughout the country, the idea of allowing people to use their sincerely held religious beliefs in making decisions on who they operate with, who they do business with. And so this is for some of those religion-based foster care and adoption agencies who might have a problem with a gay couple wanting to adopt or even foster a child.
Well, and so that bill is now law, and that law will most decidedly be challenged.
I would expect so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I'm Ben Philpott, senior editor at KUT in Austin, Texas, after a wild night there in the legislature. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, scientists at the Scripps Research Institute announced that they've modified the antibiotic vancomycin to make it harder for bacteria to develop resistance to it. The World Health Organization has warned that antibiotic-resistant superbugs pose a major threat to global health. In the U.S. alone, more than 2 million people get antibiotic-resistant infections every year. Joining us now is Jean Patel, who's the director of the Office of Antimicrobial Resistance at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
And how significant is this development?
So this is a really interesting finding. You know, in the laboratory, these folks were able to modify an old antibiotic and make it more active against some of our most resistant bacteria. Innovations like this are going to be really important for trying to address the problem of treating these really hard-to-treat or nearly impossible-to-treat infections caused by resistant bacteria.
And this antibiotic vancomycin, what do we use that for?
This is a drug that's used for treating some of our most serious infections that can occur, especially in healthcare settings. And these are infections caused by bacteria like Staphylococcus aureus. It's a very common cause of infections in healthcare settings.
And as we said, more than 2 million people are getting antibiotic-resistant infections every year in the United States. Is the problem getting worse? And if so, why?
So the problem is getting worse, and I think in the near term we can predict that we're going to continue to see this problem grow. We have bacteria that are now resistant to nearly all antibiotics, and this has happened because we really over-relied on the use of antibiotics for treating patients, and we used antibiotics when they weren't necessary. And this led to increased resistance. You know, another factor is that we see bacteria that are able to exchange resistance, share their resistance with other bacteria, and that's resulted in a growing problem as well. One of the messages that CDC really wants people to know is that efforts to prevent an infection are going to be very important for addressing this problem. We're always going to need more drugs, and innovations like this are great. But if we can prevent these infections from happening in the first place, then we're really going to make progress in dealing with this public health threat.
Well, how do you do that? How do you prevent these infections from happening in the first place?
So in a healthcare setting, some of the prevention measures are really simple, like washing hands when interacting with patients. So you wash your hands before you interact with a patient and afterward, and that prevents transmission of bacteria from one patient to another. Some of the strategies can become more focused. So, for example, when patients are infected or colonized with a resistant bacteria, sometimes you implement special precautions like using gowns whenever interacting with a patient and then removing those gowns before you meet with another patient.
But if we get to the point where clearly we are today, where people are getting these antibiotic-resistant infections, are we always going to be chasing the next level of antibiotic because the infections are going to figure out their way around the ones we have now?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're always going to have antibiotic-resistant infections. With each new drug and each new innovative drug that comes to market, we can expect to still see resistance to that drug. And that's why we have to take a multi-pronged approach to addressing this problem. Not only innovation, but also good infection control, making sure that we use the antibiotics that we do have only when necessary. All of these approaches are going to help us get a handle on this problem.
That's Jean Patel, who's director of the Office of Antimicrobial Resistance at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, the wait is finally over for House of Cards fans. Season 5 of the Netflix series is now available for streaming. Creator Bo Willimon and executive producer David Fincher debuted their remake of the British political drama back in February 2013, and since then it's become a huge hit for Netflix. House of Cards stars Kevin Spacey as the ruthless and manipulative South Carolina politician Frank Underwood, and Robin Wright as his equally merciless wife Claire. Also at Frank Underwood's side is his chief of staff, Doug Stamper.
Are you Doug? My failsafe?
Do you doubt that?
We're flying full throttle into a hurricane, and you're talking office politics instead of focusing on making sure we don't get ripped apart.
You're right, sir.
That's Michael Kelly as Doug Stamper. We spoke to him as season 4 began last year.
Well, and I guess the only spoiler I'll give away is the reason we're talking to you is because you're still in the show in season 4. So now that that's out of the way, what do you think about the cultural phenomenon that this show has become?
I think it's incredible. I mean, I've often said that when I first signed on to do this show, you know, you had David Fincher and Kevin Spacey and Bo Willimon and Robin. Everyone was already attached. And I read the scripts and I was like, wow, okay, I know we're going to make a great show. I just don't know if anyone's ever going to see it, you know. Netflix was the unknown, funny enough, in the equation at the time. So to see what's happened with that around the world now with them is just so impressive what they've accomplished.
Did you base your character on a real-life political staffer?
No. Thank goodness. no, I
any
did.
Part of it? I mean, even just the way that you are.
No, I mean, I did. I did speak with a prominent New York chief of staff, and that person gave me some insight as to the daily workings of a chief of staff, the monotony, and actually the sometimes quite boring tasks that one does. So I did that. I had a decent political background from studying political science in college, but I don't think anything could prepare me for for playing Doug. But no, there's no specific person. I do believe he's probably based on a combination of people, and then also obviously from the original show, maybe taken a little bit there. I'm not sure.
Well, let's take a listen to a little bit of your character, and this is from the first season. You are, as we said, the chief of staff to Mr. Underwood, and you also, your character has a drinking problem. Here you are at an AA meeting in season 1.
Most people see fear as a weakness. It can be. Sometimes for my job, I have to put fear in other people. I know that's not right, but if I'm honest, like the fourth step asks us to be, I have to be ruthless, because failure's not an option.
Now, as we sort of joked about at the top, you are still here in season 4, but in this world of TV shows that where they managed to kill off main characters on a regular basis, were you worried about that? Is that something that goes through your mind as you're playing a character like this? And there is a very real possibility that you will go away.
Yeah, of course. It's something I worry about. I still finish a script and breathe a sigh of relief
that you're still
when
there.
I don't.
Right.
I don't die. We don't have a problem killing off characters on House of Cards. That's for me to have made it this long and almost not at the end of season 2 there. Everyone thought he was gone. I feel, man, this really is – this character, this job has just been the greatest gift to me ever. The writing is so incredible. So I would hate for it to end, man. I love it so much.
I want to go back to when House of Cards debuted in 2013, because this was the first original drama series produced by Netflix. And I wonder whether you felt some pressure, you and all the other people working on the show, felt some pressure, because if this had been a disaster, people would have said, oh, well, these Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, they can't do TV shows. That's got to be done by the networks.
Yeah, no. I mean, funny enough, there wasn't pressure on us because none of us knew what it exactly was even, you know. I remember, like I said, saying like, well, you know, I know we're going to make a great show, but I don't know if anyone's going to see it. We didn't know what Netflix was, you know, at the time. And granted, I'm a little bit older. I'm not so tech savvy, you know, so I'm sure there were kids who were like, oh, of course, it's going to be a streaming show. It'll be perfect. It'll be great. But for me, I was like, that's where I got my DVDs in the mail, you know. Mm. So the pressure wasn't really there. You know, I remember, I think it was Constance Zimmer who played Janine Skorsky said to me, you know, we were filming and a few of us were hanging out. We were many episodes in and we had seen the first couple rough cuts and we knew we were making something really special. And she said, do you think we'll be eligible for an Emmy? I was like, I don't know. I mean, what is it? Is it TV? Is it stream? We didn't wrap our heads around what it was we were doing at the time.
What do you think it is now? Do you consider it TV?
Yes, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I think that, you know, I will tell my children are now 3 and 6, and I'll tell Frankie and Clinton one day, I'll say, hey, guys, you know how you watch TV? We started that. I don't think we'll have 100 or 1,500 cable channels anymore. I think you'll pay for what you want to consume. And I think Netflix is in large part responsible for what will become how we view television.
House of Cards actor Michael Kelly speaking to us in March of last year. House of Cards Season 5 is available for streaming today. Britain will hold an election next week which will determine whether the Prime Minister is the Conservative Theresa May or the Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. Last night, they appeared at a candidates' forum where they were questioned by journalist Jeremy Paxman. A lot of Jeremys. Here's an exchange between May and Paxman.
Theresa May, when did you realise that you'd got the wrong answer to the biggest question of our times in politics?
Do you mean you're talking about Brexit?
Well, of course.
We gave people the choice, Jeremy. Yeah. And the British people decided to leave the European Union. Yeah. And I think it's important for them to see their politicians delivering on that choice and respecting the will of the people.
Joining us now is the BBC's Rob Watson. And Rob, when May called this election in April, she was way ahead in the polls. Now it's much closer. What happened?
Yes, Jeremy, number three, if you didn't mind me calling you that. It has been an extraordinary development because Theresa May, when she called the election, absolutely, she had a lead over the opposition Labour Party of 24%. I mean, over the course of the campaign, that lead has gone down by at least a half in the polls. In a way, it was always a risky strategy. I mean, she made this election about her leadership. I'm the strong and stable leader that can give Britain a great deal as it leaves the European Union. But of course, if you make a campaign about yourself and you give less than a stellar performance, guess what? People look at your frailties and limitations as a politician, and that's precisely what has happened to Theresa May.
So what would be their differences on Brexit, for example? What would Jeremy Corbyn do, or what do people think he would do if he becomes Prime Minister?
Well, that's one of the problems that the opposition Labour Party faces, that actually on that issue, people really don't see much of a difference. I mean, they see that both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party are committed to following through on the referendum. So then the question becomes for the voters, well, who do you think would get a better deal? Who do you think would be the tougher negotiator? And that does actually play to Theresa May's strength rather than to Jeremy Corbyn's. But it's just that some of the kind of the tarnish of her image has gone a bit because she has had a number of slip-ups in the campaign and she has at times just looked horribly wooden when facing us guys in the media.
Let's listen to another clip from last night. This is Jeremy Corbyn, who's been compared to Bernie Sanders in this country, making his case.
Are you happy that so many of our children are going to school with supersized classes? So many of our children are going to school hungry? Are you happy with so many people waiting for hospital operations, a million waiting for social care?
Rob Watson, you're in Cardiff, Wales right now. You've been traveling around the UK. Are these the issues that people are talking about to you?
you know, it's important to note that that like Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn is offering a pretty radical alternative. I mean, he's basically, it's what I'd call the message of the populist left, that Britain is a country rigged in favour of the rich and privileged, and we need to kind of tax them and big businesses and even things up. I mean, some people will buy into that, but I guess an awful lot of people have a problem with the messenger. And so I'm not sure that he's had the sort of radical cut through that he would like. But I mean, are there plenty of people who think that Britain is not as equal as it might be? You betcha. But do they necessarily think that higher taxes and more government spending is the answer? Well, not necessarily.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson. Rob, the election just about a week away. We'll be watching. Thanks so much.
All right. Cheers, Jeremy.
Comedian Dimitri Martin first broke on the scene on Jon Stewart's The Daily Show back in 2005. Dimitri went on to create his own Comedy Central show and continue his successful career as a stand-up comic, sometimes accompanying himself on guitar.
I think batteries are the most dramatic object of all the objects. Because other things, they stop working or they break. But batteries, they die.
Death, as we'll hear, has become a recurring theme in some of the quirky cartoons in Dimitri's books and in his new film, Dean, which Dimitri Martin wrote, directed, and stars in as Dean, an illustrator who's blocked on a new book. Could be because his mother has just died and his father, played by Kevin Klein, is trying to move on, start a new chapter in his life, although with some difficulty.
Oh, my God. That's my new friend. Sorry. Here we go. I can't talk now. I'm with my son. You see, I'm busy.
I can't see you. It's more of a voice thing.
Oh, you think you can't see me? Yeah, dream on. They know what's going on at the other end of this thing. There. Oh, well, I just took a picture of my sandwich. Okay, hang on. Come on!
Kevin Klein and Dimitri Martin in Martin's new film, Dean. And Dimitri Martin joins us from the NPR studios in Culver City. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You know from whence you speak in this film.
Yes.
Your dad died when you were just 20. And we understand you've been losing your mom.
Yeah. This is going to be a fun chat.
Isn't it? She has...
Tears of a clown.
Oh, she has Alzheimer's?
She does. Yeah. Sadly, my mom got early onset Alzheimer's when she was 56. And she's been sick for about 8 or 9 years now. It's terrible.
Yeah. And so your character, Dean, is wandering through life losing.
Yeah, you know, I mostly do stand-up comedy, and I'm suddenly 20 years into stand-up, and I love jokes, and I spend most of my time writing them and then trying to tell them to people. But to make a first film here, I felt compelled to share something personal, and while the film is fiction, it comes from a very real place and the kind of things I've been dealing with.
Yeah. Well, and we shouldn't give the wrong impression. This film is charming. It's hilarious at times.
Thanks. Yeah, it is a comedy, for sure. It sounds sad, and it's funny. I think for those of us who don't work in radio, you put the headphones on, and you get sucked into this. I got to try not to whisper. You know, it's so kind of fun to be on radio, but I'm like, okay, just talk like a regular person, you know.
Well, and part of the humor in the film is that you're a cartoonist, and your character is, as you are, someone who draws. So throughout the film, we have these illustrations to what's going on. In the opening to the film, your character is drawing the letter capital A, and there's an arrow pointing to that little hole in the top of the capital A, and the caption reads, "Real A-hole," which you just got me to say on the radio.
I'm psyched on NPR. Right?
What's happening in your head, Dimitri's head? That do you see things like this all the time?
Yeah, I learned early on in my stand-up career to carry a notebook with me. I write jokes and then I end up drawing a lot. And I find it relaxing and I guess therapeutic. It's definitely a great escape for me because I can, on a plane, in an airport, in a cab, wherever I am, you know, I do the road a lot. I can always escape into my notebook. So it's nice.
Can you give some other examples maybe of recent observations?
Sure. It's funny. I was just sitting here waiting to do this interview and I drew a guy sitting on a chair and he has a thought bubble is where his head should be. And then there's a little circle that leads to what should be the thought bubble. But his head is floating in the air. And his thoughts are on his shoulders. And then it just says, "I feel weird" in the thought bubble. I think there's potential there. It's all hit or miss for me. It's all volume. That's what I've learned. And same with my one-liners, with my jokes. I'm just constantly searching for something interesting to share with people.
Yeah. Well, your character in the film starts realizing that, you know, the Grim Reaper is everywhere in his cartoons. It's just like, how did he get there? Give some examples.
Yeah, there's a picture of my character. I guess it's somewhat of a self-portrait, water skiing. And then you pan over and there's the Grim Reaper. He's going by behind another boat. There's the Grim Reaper has a caddy who's pulling a sickle out of the golf bag for him.
The little Grim Reaper caddy.
Smaller, yeah. It's strange because in my own drawings, you know, I did that book a few years ago. I'm going to have another one in the fall. I'm excited. A lot of just single panel cartoons, I guess you call them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it turned out a lot of them had the Grim Reaper in them just in my real life. And I don't have to dig too deep to say, yeah, I've dealt with some stuff. My family's going through some things. So there he is, mm-hmm. you know, or she, whoever the Grim Reaper is. You know, I haven't gotten a good look at the face ever.
That's funny, since you're the artist. One drawing is your character drawing himself, you know, kneeling at
a guillotine.
And down the ramp from the guillotine are bowling pins.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
sick.
I like that one. I know. Imminence is always funny to me. You know.
Well, so we're you know, kind of smiling through tears here, especially I can't help but think about in real life, your mom, you know?
Yeah. There is something very strange about when you lose your parents. Aside from the grief, when both parents are gone, I do things and I realize I'll never share that with them. I'll never get their validation.
Mm-hmm.
I have two kids now. I'm married. These are big milestones in life. And sometimes you want to pick up the phone and call them, or you're having mm-hmm. a rough day and you want to share something. And of course, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Being a comedian and now making a first film, and I draw and write, you know, I realize that it's a lucky thing if you get to have a job where you can channel those kinds of feelings and experiences, you know, maybe mm-hmm. make something that resonates with other people.
Does your mom know you have a film?
No, she's, mm-hmm. it's been about 4 or 5 years since she knew who I was, and mm-hmm. she didn't know I got married or never met my kids, or she doesn't know them. The last time I saw her, she couldn't speak. She was kind of catatonic, just to sell the movie here.
Oh.
Lots of laughs from this guy. I know. It's terrible. It's just, it's so terrible. It's so strange. Being a grown-up just, it really does suck sometimes. You know, it's just, there are these things you don't have answers for. There's no solution. And the original title of my film was The First Thing You Never Get Over. And mm. when I lost my dad, I realized that was it for mm. me.
You've shifted to filmmaking. That's a big change. But
yeah.
did you ever
I
think...
like the word shift. That makes it sound like I'm driving or something.
Right.
I wish it were that smooth.
Just go over in that lane.
Yeah.
But did you ever think, I just don't feel funny anymore? You know,
yeah.
with the sadness, have you, you know, was there a moment when you thought maybe I can't do stand-up?
I haven't felt that, but I have felt that I wanted to have the laughs be earned if they could. When I set out to make a film. Mm-hmm. What I like about jokes is they're things. They're these little things that I can think about, make one, share it with people. Here's another one.
Like, why do you all, when you had a surprise birthday party for me, why did you all come in and yell surprise?
Right.
If you yelled some other thing like confidence.
Yeah, like surprise is the least surprising word to yell. Any other word would be, it would be more of a surprise. Yeah, if I came in, you yelled turtles or something. Whoa. That's surprising. Now you got me. Yeah, I think there's something wonderful about the experience of daydreaming, coming up with something, and then getting onto a stage somewhere. There's a connection with other human beings. It feels great. But I have purposefully shied away from dealing with more personal subjects. But here, trying to make a movie, I'm thinking, geez, if someone's going to spend 90 minutes looking at my mug up there and my story, I want it to be something they can connect with.
Just briefly, the music you used for the film, Pete Dello and Honeybus, 70s mm. music that you had, it's got such a sweet sound. What were
Thanks.
You doing with that?
I love that. Yeah, I had that album. I'm a Pete Dello fan, and I had no budget for music or really anything in this movie. This is a truly small, independent film. And I don't know, it just worked. You know, I think of Cat Stevens and Harold and Maude. You know, Simon and Garfunkel in The Graduate. Now, my movie is not those, but I thought there could be this musical signature through the movie, or kind of a backbone.
Yeah. Well, it's lovely. It's lovely.
Thank you.
It's what you've got. It's what you've got. It's what you've got. It's what you got.
Well, Dimitri Martin, remember that stand-up joke I referenced? Surprise!
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Yes, this is my birthday today.
Are you looking around nervously? Like we're all going to jump out.
Yeah, exactly. What is an NPR surprise like? It's very calm. It's very sensible and responsible.
Right. That's actor, writer, and director Dimitri Martin. His new film is Dean. Dimitri, thank you.
Robin, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Terry Gross is going to jump out any minute now.
Yeah, that's good.
Just like her.
It's what you've got. In the mid-1800s, more than 500,000 Americans migrated west in covered wagons along the Oregon Trail. Some were searching for riches or land. Some were fleeing religious persecution. But no one has authentically crossed the trail in over a century. That is until Rinker Buck, a journalist with a penchant for adventure. Jacob Lewis of Nashville Public Radio's podcast Neighbors has Buck's story.
Dreams can be a pain in the neck.
Because you get out there and you go, oh, I just have to keep going.
In 2011, Rinker Buck attempted to cross the Oregon Trail, that thing from pioneer days that you learned about in middle school. Well, Rinker did it with a team of mules, 2,000 sometimes miserable miles.
It's raining and you're wet, and the rain comes in through the front of the covered wagon and gets all over you, and you put a blanket on you, and that's wet. So it just took a lot of persistence, just a lot of persistence.
What's the real reason? Why'd you do it?
I guess the real reason, and it's something I discovered along the trail, is that I'm much more my father's son than I thought.
His dad was a pilot named Tom Buck. He had 11 children, of which Rinker was somewhere in the middle. Tom lost a leg in a plane crash in World War II, but this didn't keep him down. He was an accomplished horseman, one that restored old wagons and even took his family on a trip in one. On it, he tacked a sign on the back that said, "See America Slowly." When Rinker was 15, he and one of his older brothers followed their father's example and took up flying. And it made them pretty famous.
Our first guest on To Tell the Truth is the youngest person ever to pilot an airplane across the United States.
Rinker Buck. Rinker, would you come up?
This is the 60s game show called To Tell the Truth. The reason Rinker and his brother were on this episode is that they had built a small plane in their backyard and then flew it across the country by themselves.
How in the world did you and your brother ever get your parents' permission for this flight?
Well, like someone said here, my father is a pilot already. And my mother, well, she just kind of does what my father says.
I don't know what else to say other than it was the 60s. Well, Rinker grew up and became a print journalist like his father. At age 60, he longed for another adventure. So on assignment in Kansas, he saw a marker for the Oregon Trail. And that spirit was stirred up once again. But he would need a co-pilot.
There is not a person in America tougher than my brother Nick.
He considers tents for wimps and sleeps outside naked in a sleeping bag. After months of planning, the two set off.
You basically follow the Platte to the Sweetwater, to the Bear, to the Snake, to the Portneuf, and so forth, till you get to the Columbia River Gorge. As long as you're within sight of those rivers, you're on the trail, because the pioneers were all over the place.
An estimated 500,000 people made the journey. It was the mid-1800s, and President James K. Polk was rushing to claim the West. Today, roughly half of the trail is paved state highway, and the other half is pretty much like it was. Rinker and his brother went along with their thoughts, their own voices, and the plodding of hooves. And on the back of their wagon was a sign, "See America Slowly." They discovered it's not so easy to do.
The toughest thing we faced on the trip was wind. Okay, the prevailing wind out on the plains. There's no forests out there or anything else. You can be going along with a 40-mile-an-hour wind on your face all day, spitting sand and gravel in your face and stuff. And I mean, there were days that the gravel being blown at us by the wind was so severe, it left marks on my face.
In the Wyoming desert, they had issues with water. From there, they inched into the mountains where they broke a wagon wheel 40 miles from civilization.
Nature and a lot of other things were giving me a lot of pushback. And it wasn't doing nature any good, because the harder nature pushed back on me, the more I wanted to finish the trip. I learned on that trip that adversity emboldens you.
adversity doesn't necessarily make you want to give up.
At the border of Idaho, they came to a fork in the road. To the right was what looked like an easy, gently sloping section of the trail, but so overgrown, the wagon couldn't get through. To the left, a 2,300-foot drop over three-quarters of a mile. Rinker and Nick tied logs to the back of the wagon to create drag. They rode the brakes all the way down.
And they were smoking this ugly, foul-smelling rubber fume when we got to the bottom of the valley.
They conquered the cliff, but they hit a rough snowstorm near Baker City, Oregon. And after 4 months in the wagon, they decided it was time to call the journey done. By the time they pulled into that last stop, Rinker says he was a changed man.
I was completely relaxed, completely comfortable, driving that team in, unhitching them myself while my brother talked to a bunch of people. Nothing bothered me, nothing worried me. Uncertainty no longer bothered me. So I would say it was kind of a baptism by deep travel, you know.
But one baptism wasn't enough. So Rinker Buck built a flat-bottom boat. He called it Patience. He floated from Elizabeth, Pennsylvania, down the Ohio River until he reached the Mississippi, which he took all the way to New Orleans. For Here and Now, I'm Jacob Lewis.
Just glad nobody died of dysentery like they did in the game. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.